This is Courtney Mitchell.
And Jennifer Murnan.
And you're listening to Deep Green Resistance Radio,
a podcast news service in celebration of resistance worldwide, released weekly.
Deep Green Resistance is an environmental and social justice organization based on the book Deep Green Resistance, Strategy to Save the Planet. The book identifies civilization, patriarchy, and capitalism as the brutal arrangements of power that need to be dismantled for the Earth to survive. Deep Green Resistance argues for a concerted, focused, and serious resistance movement that can stop the murder of the planet before it's too late. On this episode of DGR Radio, Mohawk protesters blockade rail lines in eastern Ontario, William Falk on recent police sexual violence against women in San Diego, DGR's Rachel Ivey on the roots of patriarchy and resistance to male violence, Marshal Eddie Conway is released from prison after 44 years, the Jericho Movement fights to free political prisoners, and a brief rundown of recent DGR actions worldwide. And we begin with Direct Action News. On Saturday, March 1st, Mohawk protesters calling for an inquiry into missing and murdered Aboriginal women occupied CN rail tracks in Napanee, Eastern Ontario, Canada. Provincial police say four protesters were arrested, and three of them will face charges. The blockade led to CN issuing a stop order for all trains. Police say a man struck the window of an unmarked police cruiser, breaking the glass. VIA Rail issued a travel advisory on Saturday, saying the blockade affects the movement of VIA Rail trains on the Toronto-Montreal and Toronto-Ottawa routes in both directions. The stop order was lifted in the early afternoon. Protesters had vowed the previous Friday to step up their protests in response to a parliamentary report into missing and murdered Indigenous women that rejected calls for a full public inquiry. Spokesman Sean Brandt has said that there will be consequences for a national inquiry not being called. The activists have been blockading a road east of Belleville since the previous Sunday night. You're listening to DGR Radio. Jennifer recently spoke with William Falk of DGR San Diego on recent police sexual violence against women.
Thank you so much, Will, for joining us here. And I just want to hear you explain what this serious situation is that's going on down in San Diego.
Yeah, thank you for having me on to talk about it. I guess it's not circumstances that I'd want to be talking about, but there are bad things going on in San Diego. It's all getting a lot of publicity here, and the issue is sexual misconduct and sexual violence at the hands of on-duty San Diego police officers.
Is this sexual violence against women?
This is sexual violence against women, yes. And it's been breaking in the news a lot lately in the last month or so, but I'd like to start with 2011, because that was kind of the first year when the San Diego Police Department started to get a bunch of bad press for a series of misconducts. There were 9 serious misconduct complaints, and 4 of them were sexually related. So what happened, the first of the sexually related misconduct complaints was a police officer was convicted of stalking a fellow police officer, a female that he had been dating, who he had met through the police department. Some of the series of stalking that he did were while he was on duty and she was on duty while they were at work. A little bit after that, also in 2011, a vice officer working for the San Diego Police Department was accused of having sex with a 19-year-old college student while he was on duty. She, the 19-year-old college student, accused him of raping her and said that she had not given consent to the intercourse. Eventually, the charges were dropped because the prosecutor said that there was not enough evidence to prove that the woman had not given consent to this police officer. Those two sound pretty bad, but then it kept getting worse. Another officer was arrested on charges of domestic violence for battering his wife. I'm not sure exactly what happened with with those charges. The press coverage kind of fell off, I think, because of the fourth and most serious of the sexual misconduct and sexual violence against women to come out of the San Diego Police Department in 2011. And that came from a man named Anthony Arevalos, who ended up being convicted on 8 felonies. All of those felonies had to do with sexual violence against women.
Was this a member of the police department there, of course? Is that right?
He was a member of the police department, and he was, I'm not sure what the right term is, but he was just a sort of a regular beat cop. His role was patrolling the gas lamp district in San Diego, which is kind of a place for nightlife, shops and restaurants and bars and that kind of thing. And he was regularly put on in his squad car to patrol that beat. And I guess that kind of brings me to some of the most disturbing aspects of Arevalos' conduct. He was patrolling in his squad car there when he was arrested in 2011 as part of the investigation and eventual trial. The San Diego Police Department had to give up their internal files on him. And it was learned that in 2009, so 2 years before this, a woman who had been stopped by Arevalos told an investigating detective that this police officer, Arevalos, had wanted a sexual favor in exchange for not arresting her. There was no action taken by the San Diego Police Department at that time.
What action was taken against him as all of this unfolded?
As all of it unfolded, well, there was another accusation in 2010.
Even more?
Yeah, there was more.
Oh, my gosh.
And there was something done in February of 2010. A woman accused Arevalos of sexually assaulting her in the back of his squad car. The police department recommended criminal charges, but the district attorney declined to charge him. And then the horrible thing is that Arevalos was put right back on his beat, back in the gas lamp district, patrolling in his squad car. So that was two accusations at that time that the San Diego Police Department knew about, and even worse, the San Diego Police Department had presented the district attorney with the accusations, recommending criminal charges, and the district attorney failed to charge him. So finally, in 2011, in March of 2011, a woman accused Arevalos of asking for her underwear in exchange for letting her off the hook for, I believe it was a DUI, but what I read was that her blood alcohol content was right around the 0.08, which was the legal limit in California. But anyway, that's I guess neither here nor there. He asked for her underwear, took her underwear, and then asked her to come to the restroom in a nearby 7-Eleven. And in the 7-Eleven, he groped her and rubbed her genitals. And 3 days later, the woman who is known as Jane Doe in San Diego now came to the San Diego Police Department, explained what happened, and this was finally enough for the police department to arrest Arevalos.
Can you reiterate that a little bit? I mean, I'm trying to wrap my head around how long it took them to finally act on all of this evidence that this sexual assault was going on with this officer. How long? How long? Is that a year, two years?
I think 18 months. So September 2009 was the first accusation, in which no action was taken. Then in February 2010, so 5 months after that, were the accusations made by a woman that she was assaulted in the back of a squad car. And the police department investigated and recommended criminal charges, but the district attorney declined the charge, so Arevalos was not fired, was not asked to resign, was not. From what I know, I don't know that there was any sort of disciplining. I just know that he returned to his beat in February 2010. So then a year, 13 months after that, in March of 2011, finally, after Jane Doe came forward about the incident at the 7-Eleven, he was finally arrested and removed from the San Diego Police Department. So, yeah, 18 months.
Wow. So is he the only person in this police department that, I mean, obviously he suffered consequences and now he's criminally charged, but are there other incidences?
Well, there, other than the ones that happened earlier in 2011 before Arevalos' trial became so public to San Diego later in 2011, I don't know of any sexual violence happening again until now here in the beginning of 2014. Nine women have come forward and accused two different officers of sexual misconduct and sexual violence. So these original, 2011 obviously was a bad year with four different cases, and then now we have two more in 2014, which is bringing this all back up into San Diego's field of vision or into their awareness.
So that's a very interesting question for me, is what has been the reaction of the community to these events?
Well, there has been outrage. In fact, just last week, a group led by women and calling themselves Fed Up San Diego held a press conference and stood at the San Diego City Building demanding institutional and systemic reforms within the San Diego Police Department, the most serious of their requests being an independent audit of the San Diego Police Department, someone to come in and examine the way they handle these situations, how they recruit, how they discipline, how they investigate these things. So there has been outrage. I think what's made this even more outrageous, and another thing that San Diego is getting upset about, is the civil case that the 13 victims of Anthony Arevalos filed after he was convicted and sentenced to prison. So I'm kind of going back to Arevalos, because I think that that'll help us as we look into what's happened in 2014, because I think there's some pretty bad reactions by the city that involved with this civil trial or civil suits that have been going on in San Diego as these women are seeking damages from the city for the way the police department handled this. That's why these women filed the civil suit. One of the problems with a criminal case or a criminal trial process is that the only recourse is going to be the sentencing of the perpetrator at the end of the trial. Once he's found guilty, he can be sentenced to prison, but it's very hard to get monetary awards for damages that a woman has suffered as a result of the sexual assaults. And obviously money is nothing compared to one's feeling of safety and well-being and all the emotional trauma and physical trauma that would go along with this. But another thing that they can do in a civil suit is ask, as part of settlement processes, that the City of San Diego and the San Diego Police Department change the way that they handle these things, so they can ask for these independent audits as part of a settlement deal, in which the City of San Diego would be contractually bound to actually enforce these things. And that's why this, the last victim of Anthony Arevalos, has refused to settle with the city, because she is standing strong and standing brave on some institutional changes being made.
And that's absolutely something that I would feel as a woman and as anybody in a culture, if the cultural institutions don't serve me or make me safe, then that needs to be changed. And I applaud her so much for doing that. Does she have a lot of support around her right now?
She has, it's hard to tell whether she has a lot of support. What is most disturbing to me is what the city has done to her after this. So the city of San Diego quite loudly applauded her during the criminal process for her bravery, for making these accusations known. But once she decided to press the issue in civil court with the city, once she made the city of San Diego a defendant and sued for the damages and sued for these institutional changes, they have begun what I would characterize as an absolute smear campaign. They've made her run through the gamut of emotions that would come through this. In fact, just in January and February, the story had broken that the San Diego City Attorney, a man named Jan Goldsmith, had filed briefs in the case accusing Jane Doe of trying to bribe Arevalos out of the DUI ticket with her underwear, saying that the reason that Arevalos had this woman's underwear is because she offered it as a way to get out of the ticket. Now, not only does that just fly in the face of everything that we know about occurrences like these in terms of, you know, all the blaming the victim kind of tactics that proliferate in these kind of cases, but we also know that Arevalos was convicted in a criminal court with a jury that has a standard, a burden of proof that the jury has to say they feel beyond a reasonable doubt that this police officer was guilty of trying to solicit sexual favors from Jane Doe. So the city attorney, by filing this brief, had to know that a judge was gonna shoot it down just based off of standards of proof that are much higher in a criminal court than in a civil court. So the city attorney did this. Eventually, when word got out to the newspapers and to the public, outrage was high enough that the city attorney amended and refiled his briefs to no longer accuse the woman of offering her underwear as a bribe. But even worse than that, the news about a week after news of the bad brief, news broke that the city attorney had spent taxpayer dollars to hire a private investigator to follow Jane Doe in her daily activities and to film her for 23 days. So the city attorney had to turn over this evidence as part of the civil trials, evidence discovery processes. And when the media and when the public got to see the films, they were films of her driving a car, they were films of her hugging her boyfriend, kissing her boyfriend on the cheek, just going about her daily business. But what this was obviously an attempt by the city attorney to try and show Jane Doe as flirtatious or as, you know, any number of words that you could imagine.
And that sounds so much like the whole awful she asked for it kind of scenario, right?
Exactly.
Is that, I mean, this is misogyny and rape culture, basically, is she must have asked for it and we're going to prove it, totally invade her privacy. And as you said just a little bit ago, victimizing the victim or slandering or slurring. Yes.
Yes.
And having that paid for by taxpayer dollars.
Right. And I guess what makes this even more, well, I mean, there's so many things that make this horrible, but even the city attorney's words afterwards, he said something to the effect of, it's horrible what happened to these women, but, you know, we can't let, as the city attorney, I can't let these women become wealthy off of the city's money. And then in response to people saying what you just said about him hiring a private investigator, he said, you know, I understand that some may see this as insensitive, but that is exactly what practicing law is. Those aren't exact quotes, but that's about what he said. So he's taking that misogynist, that classic misogynist angle and institutionalizing it through his office. He's not just the criminal defendant trying to, like I said, challenge a woman's character or challenge this woman by calling her all kinds of bad names. He's using his office to perpetuate this misogyny. And so that's just a deeper level of what's going on in things.
So, Will, it's so good that you have spent so much time, you know, understanding this and become so invested in this struggle. Why did you decide that this was so important to you?
Well, I think for several reasons. I think, first of all, I just think it struck me as I was reading the news as a classic case of misogyny and something that was so horrible that if I ignored this as a human being, I think if I ignored this or didn't read more, I felt like I don't know how I would go to sleep at night, to be perfectly honest. But on top of that, and more personally, I have a mother and I have a little sister, and I know that my mother has been stopped by the police for silly things and questioned in weird ways. And I just thought, knowing, you know, being close to those women in particular, I felt like, you know, imagine if that was someone you knew. But then also I went to law school. I was a public defender. I worked against police officers daily. And so I hold no love for the police in a general way. And when I read about this, it just seemed like the most horrible abuse of a police's power that I could imagine. I mean, we know the stats about, you know, racism within the so-called criminal justice system, where 1/3 of African men in some cities can expect to go to prison. We know how the police respond to people who are outraged by the way corporations are destroying natural communities. And so when I saw this, I was angry, and the only way I think to deal with anger is to act. So that's what I'm trying to do. Writing and researching for me is how I act, or at least the best way that I know how to act in terms of my own personal skills or propensities as a person. So, yeah, sorry that I went on so long, but, yeah, that's why.
I think that what you're saying is wonderful, and I think that what you're choosing to do with the talents that you have is extraordinary, and I applaud you for it. And that comes from, you know, being a woman and also so very much wanting to change the culture that we live in so that I can feel safe. And in order to do that, we have to be able to analyze the situation and what the root causes are. And we have to be able to create that culture that we can go to, where we can go home and we can be safe. So I wanted to see, I know that as part of this program, we're going to try to address the root causes. What would you say the root causes are for this? In the same way that this civil lawsuit is trying to go to some kind of structural accountability and change that will end the misogyny. What's your take on what the root of this is and where it comes from?
Well, quite simply, I think the root cause is patriarchy. I think when you, the police, of course, are populated by, largely by men who come from this culture. In this culture, we know many of the terrible stats. The stat like one in four women can expect to be raped in her lifetime, and even more than that, fend off rape attempts. I think that the police, because they're populated from this culture, we can expect for similar numbers to happen. So I think that patriarchy is the root cause. The police, I think, offer us sort of a unique case, or when I say unique, I mean a horrific case, in that the police also, not only are they populated largely by men, but they also represent, in my analysis, they represent the domestic arm of colonial oppression or civilization's oppression. And what I mean by that is I think there's that great line by Stanley Diamond, the anthropologist and anthropology chair at the New School for Research. He wrote a great book called In Search of the Primitive, which was a collection of essays critiquing civilization, and he said civilization originates in conquest abroad and repression at home. And I think it's easy to see armies of occupation as the conquest abroad part of that, and the police, I believe, are the repression at home. And then going even further, I think that patriarchy represses women everywhere. So the police not only fill this niche of civilization's oppression, but they also act as the arm of, as the most terrifying arm of the repression of women. So I think if we're going to get to the root of the problem in San Diego and everywhere, because it's happening everywhere, we have to be combating the material functioning of patriarchy. And I think settling for anything less than that is ultimately doomed to failure.
After the conclusion of our interview, I asked if Will would answer a couple of questions for me, and he sent back this email in response to my questions. The first one was, has there been any national coverage of the police sexual assaults in San Diego? And his response was, while I've been researching news stories of the events in San Diego, I have seen little to no coverage outside of San Diego publications. The only non-San Diego publication to pick up the story that I could see was the Los Angeles Times. I think their coverage is easily explained by San Diego's close proximity to LA. The second question was, why do you think there has been very little coverage? And Will's response was this. There has been so little coverage because sexual assault by police officers are happening everywhere. Yesterday, on March the 17th, 2014, he said, I Googled the term sexual assault by police, and my first screen was filled with hits bringing news of sexual assaults by police from different cities all over the country. There was a story from Detroit, Michigan,
Irwindale, California, Woodland Park, New Jersey, San Jose, California, and San Antonio, Texas. Then I performed the same search this morning on March the 18th, 2014, Will goes on to say, and there were two or three new stories on top of the ones I saw yesterday. This tells me that the sexual assaults by police officers in San Diego are by no means unique. These sexual assaults are happening everywhere, and they are happening often.
I am in total agreement with Will. This is horrifying.
I've seen him sleeping in the parking lot in cardboard boxes. I've seen him walking streets and turning cheeks sky high as rockets. I've seen him go to war then come back home to unemployment. I've seen him work a 9-to-5 for life with unfulfillment. So where do we go from here? I need to know. Where do we go from here? Where do we go from here? We need to fight together, together, together. I've seen him reaching through the garbage can for our leftovers. I've seen him spend their lesson on the winning game of numbers. I've seen him once on high school track team, now they're only runners. Can someone please tell me what happened to our sons and daughters? So where do we go from here? Where do we go from here? Where do we go from here? We need to fight together, together, together. Where do we go from here? Where do we go from here? Where do we go from here? We need to fight together, together, together. Victim of circumstance, product of environment, caught up in the system, long-term convict, minority to the majority of the violence, yet seen as thieves and tyrants, lost in the world, so short on tolerance, got an itchy finger, can't call for dinner, scratch the car with a coin and hope that you're a winner, taking any chance to get another chance to escape from the cancer of poverty and probably in the same boat as those trying to stay afloat, keeping up with the Joneses while pushing on a rowboat with one paddle, not understanding that the battle is never leaving the deck, never paycheck to paycheck, barely making ears meet, feet hitting concrete, baby kissing mom cheek, reason she survives weeks, only 4 hours sleep, raised in these city streets, when will we ever see a change in humanity? Where do we go from here? I need to know. Where do we go from here? Where do we go from here? We need to fight together, 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 yeah. Where do we go from here? Where do we go from here? Yeah. Where do we go from here? We need to fight together, together, together.
This is Deep Green Resistance Radio with Courtney Mitchell and Jennifer Murnan. Gender is the chain and patriarchy is the ball, cuffed to the ankle of every female child born into this world. A world where every mainstream institution and structure of power is set up to preserve male dominance. That's a quote from DGR's Rachel Ivey. Rachel recently spoke with Jennifer about the roots of patriarchy and resistance to men's violence against women.
Hi, Rachel. Thank you for joining this podcast and for coming in to talk a little bit more, a lot more actually, about patriarchy and why violence against women, such as what Will just was saying earlier about the violence in San Diego perpetrated against women, is so pervasive.
Well, I think, first of all, thanks for having me on, Jennifer. And I really was glad that Will touched on the depth of this problem. I think, you know, we can look at different factors and different sort of symptoms of it in terms of different ways that male violence comes out, but what we're left with is the question of why is this so pervasive? And it really points to the basis of cultures that are patriarchal. Cultures that are patriarchal are organized in such a way that resources, be them sex or reproduction or labor, are extracted from female people systemically. And this becomes compounded when you realize that people are also exploited because of race and in socioeconomic ways. And when you layer that on top of the inherent sexism, it becomes even more of a problem. So I think that when we're addressing these issues, I think if we want to be successful, something that we need to keep in mind and something that we need to act on, not just pay lip service to, is the fact that it's so pervasive and so ingrained in not only our mindset, but in the way that our society is organized.
And so you said if we're going to act on this, if we are going to in any way realistically change this situation, what do you think are some of the steps that we should take? I know that you have an organization going.
Yeah, so I, a really good friend of mine, started an organization, a nonprofit called Warrior Sister Society, out of Eugene, Oregon, which is where we're based. And the goal of this nonprofit is very simple. It's just to provide free self-defense training and materials to women in need. So we interpret women in need to mean particularly women in vulnerable populations. So far we've been doing our trainings at homeless shelters, high schools, and we just now have gotten the opportunity to do open trainings that can be open to, you know, all age groups and demographics of women. So I think that one of the reasons this project is so attractive to me is because it is organized by women for women, and it attempts to address these problems more at their root. I mean, especially, you know, Will's interview really pointed out that for a lot of women that are faced with sexual assault, going to the police is not a helpful response, not only because less than 2% of rapists ever see a day behind bars. Most of the time, women are bullied into saying that they made it up or into not reporting, but in another even more disturbing section of those instances where it is reported, someone in law enforcement is the perpetrator. And so you're being forced to report a crime to the exact same body of people that perpetrated it and that facilitate it being covered up and it being continuous. So what we want to do, and what women in, you know, for centuries literally, but also in many different places around the world today are doing, is organizing with more of a focus on direct action. Women need to have the tools to physically defend themselves, because pleading with a rapist is not as effective as incapacitating them. And if we want rape to end, we need to make it clear that women are organized, women can fight back, and we can win in those fights.
Do you see any similarities between the Sister Warrior Society and what's going to be happening in San Diego? It sounds like they're different just from, you know, a little bit of analysis.
I think they are. I think that we need all kinds of tactics when we do this. I think that differences in organizations are great. I think that there are women who are having a lot of success and are fighting like hell through the legal system, through getting information out and through education. That's so important. But our stance is that we also need a direct action element to that. I think with any fight, a diversity of tactics and a multitude of organizations, even if they're coming at it from different angles, especially if they're coming at it from different angles, really makes a difference. One example that we sort of look up to and that we had heard about before starting this group was the Gulabi Gang in India. Or the Pink Sari Gang, as it translates, and they are amazing. They're a direct action group of women that not only trains each other in self-defense, but retaliates against men who perpetrate violence against women, any form of violence. So, yeah, I think there's so much exciting work going on right now, and I was really excited to hear about what's going on in San Francisco.
In San Diego?
San Diego.
Yeah, I think that there was a similar group of women in China also. I remember the interview that I did with Stephanie McMillan where they were talking She was talking about the book, the Rapist Annihilation Squad book.
Knitting Circle,
Rapist Annihilation Squad. Yeah, and one of the genesises for that book was similar actions by women taken in China to stop violence and rape against women. And really rapidly changing the culture, making it totally unacceptable. Yeah.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, yeah, so I remember that piece. So can you say a little bit more about the organization and how long you've been around, some contact information, ways to get involved? Are there ways to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. We are relatively new. Within the last year, we've been, had a name and been trying to get things off the ground. And really in the last couple of months, things have picked up largely through community support. So because we offer free services, the biggest challenge we have is being able to do that and being able to provide them for free. So all of the materials that we've been able to accumulate so far, pads for training and rubber knives to learn to disarm each other and hand wraps, and the space that we're renting in one instance to actually train in are all through donations. So that is something that I've really been excited to see, is a lot of people, feeling an identification with this cause and with this group and wanting to contribute. And fundraising is an absolutely heroic way of doing that as far as we're concerned. So that is definitely one way that people can get involved. Our website is women-selfdefense.org. Or you can Google Warrior Sister Society, and there's a PayPal link on there. Other things that we're really hoping begin to happen for us is other chapters of Warrior Sisters. We have worked really hard to set this one up, but we're really hoping that it doesn't remain the only one now that we have a structure, now that we have sort of a model that seems to be working for us. We'd love to eventually be able to export that and give other women the opportunity to organize under Warrior Sisters and to get women in their communities trained. We're really excited about it. We have gotten such an amazing response from women that we have been training, women who had never, I think I get the most gratification out of helping women get training when they've never been involved in self-defense before. A lot of the time they're really sort of hesitant at the beginning. They feel kind of silly punching pads that I'm holding for them. But, within a couple classes, women will come back and say, I have been carrying myself completely differently in public. I've been really aware of my surroundings. I've felt really good that I had any kind of skill to react. And these are women that live with such adversity and such violence every day, as so many women do. So I think that is really what makes it worth it to organize around this issue, is that it's extremely, you can see the results. It's a very concrete sort of reward for this work, is getting to interact with women and, empower them to be able to have control over their lives, their bodies.
So how would a person or a group of women reach out to you to start a chapter? Do you have a specific way to do that yet?
We have an email address, warriorsistersociety@gmail.com, and that would be the best way to reach out to us. This isn't something that we've done before as far as getting chapters started in other places. One is a milestone for us, so two would definitely be a milestone for us. So I think that, that's something I'm excited about figuring out, is how, I don't think it's going to look the same in every place. I think there's going to be different communities with different needs in every place that Warrior Sisters get started. So I'm really excited that, it's going to be an adventure. It's going to be a new thing for us when that starts, but definitely something that we're interested in figuring out together with other women that are interested in helping.
I think And I think one of the things that you just said there, too, that this is one facet. There are also women that are doing incredible work around legal, you know, legal work, mm-hmm. all kinds of different ways to stop patriarchy. And so,
yeah, and the legal side of it is so, you know, so important. When I think the first class that we ever had, someone brought up Marissa Alexander for good reason. Mm-hmm. Marissa Alexander is a woman in Florida who is, I believe, now facing life in prison or 60 years, effectively life, for firing a warning shot that harmed no one in order to try and scare off her husband that was physically assaulting her on a regular basis. So, I mean, it's all well and good to say, you know, women physically fight back. This is something that we need to do. But there are also other factors that have a huge chilling effect on that actually being the case. So, I mean, that's something that we're really frank about. There are, and something that we're also educating around. There are things based on the laws where you live that you can do, and some things that you don't have control over in terms of how your actions are going to be reacted to legally or the implications that they're going to have. So I think that that's just an entire other side of this fight and of the support women need that is so essential. So, I mean, we need warrior sisters, but we need, you know, women who are fighting with more conventional tools as well, because it's just as essential.
Yes, and that's one of the things that immediately popped into my mind when you were talking about way earlier in this interview about some, you know, you're reporting to people and sometimes they're the perpetrators, and where do you mm-hmm. go with that? Are you aware of the situation at Tutwiler in Alabama?
No, I'm not.
Okay. That is at least a 2-decade long rape culture environment that's been happening within the only women's correctional facility in Alabama. And so there's been a pervasive atmosphere of fear and abuse that's been happening there for about 2 decades. And there is a lot of very intense legal work around changing that situation. But of course, these women had nowhere to go, and people did not believe, you know, what they were saying. And finally, after 2 decades, there's some effective work happening. So yes, sometimes you need different strategies, different tools, different ways of changing this, and that's what's appropriate there. So
sounds like such an example of what we were talking about earlier as well, with, you know, women in vulnerable populations,
yes,
that are exploited or oppressed in one way become really vulnerable in other ways as well. So women in prison, women in poverty, women that have been deprived of, you know, basic resources and freedoms and rights, tend to be vulnerable to other abuses as well. So it's really looking at not only, I mean, women in and of ourselves are a vulnerable population in terms of, you know, the rates of male violence against women, but that just becomes so intensified in certain situations, and it sounds like that's what you're describing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is pretty much what I'm describing. I also know that you have been very active in your life around reproductive rights, and that you've dedicated a lot of work to this. And that's another place where we have to have control of our own bodies. I mean, just essential.
Yeah.
So could you speak a little bit about your history with that and a few thoughts that you might have to share?
Yeah, if I had to pick a cause that I think is the most important thing that I want to devote time to, it may be reproductive justice, because I think that it's at the root of so much of the sex-based oppression that women experience. I think it's sort of the other side of the coin of male violence, like what we're addressing with warrior sisters. I said at the beginning of the interview that patriarchal cultures are set up to extract resources from female bodies, and that is absolutely the model or the framework that I would apply to reproductive extraction as well. When women are deprived of the basic human right to decide whether they reproduce and when, that is in effect extracting resources from their bodies, and it further entrenches women's second-class status in very, you know, devastatingly effectively. So I actually came into activism through, I worked for a large reproductive rights nonprofit. I lobbied senators. I was a sex ed teacher for a few years, teaching comprehensive sex ed in middle and high schools. And I loved that work. I think that the education I was doing was so important. But I also recognize that those tactics alone are not effective. We're seeing the biggest backslide in reproductive rights that we have ever in the last century experienced. You know, there's been more reproductive restrictions passed by the federal government in the last, or federal and state governments in the last 3 years than in the last 10 in total. And it's only accelerating. We're seeing women being, you know, just flat out deprived of having access because there are 87% of counties with no provider. We're seeing existing providers being terrorized out of existence. Just recently, Susan Cahill is a noted abortion provider who has dealt with a lot of backlash, and their clinic was just recently shut down because of an extremely violent and devastating episode of vandalism where literally everything in their clinic was broken and they can't continue to work. Or last I heard, they hadn't been able to recover from that. And we're seeing it in a more insidious way as well. We're seeing insurance bans. We're seeing TRAP laws, which stands for Targeted Regulation of Abortion Providers. So basically red tape that gets thrown at clinics, like your doorways have to be a certain width, or the doctor has to have admitting privileges at a hospital, which is not required for other types of medical providers, only for abortion providers, with the intent of shutting them down. So in light of this, I don't think that education and that calling our senators, as much as I value that work that I've done, as much as I value what women are doing with that, is enough. I think that, as I was saying, with male violence, we need a diversity of tactics to address this. And I think that women need to be educated about their own ability to regulate their reproductive rights and to get away from a total dependence that we have now on the medical system to provide it, because so far that, you know, this approach just isn't working.
Mm, thank you so much for sharing all of that information. I think that you can't completely address this unless you talk about everything, all the assaults that are happening.
Yeah.
And one of them that really profoundly is painful and horrific to me is pornography, of course. So I was just wanting to touch on that too before we finish off at pornography. That horrifies me, and the objectification there and the violence that it actually creates and is escalating.
Yeah, I mean, it's the propaganda of patriarchy. It's the ideological basis for what happens to women. You cannot exploit someone without turning them into an object first, and that's what pornography is so good at. You know, I feel like I have the conversation a lot with people who call themselves feminists that are okay with women's bodies being bought and sold. Women are in extremely vulnerable positions, make up most of, you know, so-called sex workers. Indigenous women, women of color, women in poverty, women who have been abused, are funneled into a trafficking system that is an industry that generates billions of dollars, mainly for wealthy countries like the U.S., while most of the victims of trafficking and pornography are not wealthy, are not of an industrialized background. So it's just an extreme imbalance in the relations of power between the sexes that's both created and then reinforced by this industry. So again, I mean, I think that this is just I think you're right, this is just another side of what we've been talking about. You know, the rates of violence against women don't come out of nowhere. You would think that it would be an easy leap to make, that maybe educating our children on images of women being degraded and violated and hurt would maybe you know, create a society where women are routinely degraded, violated, and hurt. So I think that we can't, I think you're right that we can't go without addressing every part of this because it's all interconnected. I love the Marilyn Frey. She's a feminist writer. I love her image of a birdcage to symbolize oppression. If you just look at one wire, if you just look at pornography or reproductive restrictions or rape, then you're not going to see the entire issue. You're not going to see why the bird is trapped in the cage. But if you step back and you look and you see all of those wires are systematically interrelated barriers that keep the bird from flying, then the nature of oppression becomes much clearer. And that's the best way I've ever come across to describe what women deal with.
I love that analogy, too. I think that one of the most inspirational things that I've heard in this interview about the Sister Warrior Society is when you said that when women go through this work of figuring out how to defend themselves, and then they are telling you that they walk out with an entirely different sense of who they are and how they feel in their environment. And I think that that would be a great way to kind of finish off is a little bit about that. Are you also talking about all these different aspects as you're training?
Some of them. I mean, that's something that we've run across is that for women, it just goes so much deeper than just the need for self-defense. So a lot of the time we end up training for some of the time that we have allotted for training and then talking for the rest of it. Women talk about what goes on in their lives. They talk, heart-wrenchingly about violence that they've dealt with in the last week that, you know, made them remember their training, whether they were able to use it or not. So I think that, yeah, because it's so layered and because it's so interrelated and because it's so complicated, and because these barriers are interrelated in so many ways, you can't separate them out. I mean, we have to a certain degree in order to, you know, move towards a goal, but we really can't go without addressing all of the ways that women are forced into a position where they need this kind of training. So, yeah, it's extremely gratifying to, you know, get to the point where someone feels differently walking outside. But, I mean, just as often, the sadder part of it is that, you know, women can, because this is just one part of it, it's not a cure-all. I would love to have every woman walk out of training being literally invincible and nothing will ever hurt her again, but that's not how it goes. So I think that it just points to that, you know, we have more work to do. Until that's the case, until every woman can feel that way, I think that we need to keep fighting.
And I think those circle of, having a circle of women to do that training in and to share with makes me feel much more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So one more time, Rachel, contact information at the end of the interview so that people can contribute, support, and even reach out to start a new chapter. One more time.
Yeah, absolutely. Our email address is warriorsistersociety@gmail.com, and you can also find this contact information on our website, which is womens-selfdefense.org. There's information about us and our trainings on there. There's information about how to plug in. There's a donate link if you feel like you can support us in that way. $15 pays our rent for an hour's training. $5 buys a woman hand wraps. So really, it's all useful. And you can also check us out on Facebook. All of our, we're under Warrior Sister Society, and all of our contact information is there as well.
Thank you. That was fantastic.
Great.
listening to DGR Radio with Jennifer Murnan and Courtney Mitchell. Marshall Eddie Conway is a former Black Panther Party leader who was recently released from prison after 44 years. Jennifer has more on that story.
In an interview exclusive on Wednesday, March 5th on Democracy Now!, less than 24 hours after his release, former Black Panther Party leader Marshall Eddie Conway had this to say in response to Amy Goodman's question, "Eddie, as we wrap up, what gave you hope almost 44 years behind bars?" He said, "Well, I appreciate you asking me that because I want to take this opportunity to thank the tens of thousands of people that have supported me over the years and that have sent letters, postcards, marched, rallied, organized across America, around the world. Those letters, postcards, rallies, marches, organizing, etc., gave me hope, gave me encourage, gave me energy, and kept my spirit high, and it made me know that I was loved. And that same love needs to go out to the other political prisoners that remain locked up today for almost 40 years, most of them. And one of them is a little over 44 years. They need to have that same kind of support, that same kind of encouragement, and that same kind of work to help get them free. Because I think when you know that people work and love you, then you can do work yourself. And I think those are what political prisoners are doing. Work in their particular areas, and they need to be encouraged to do that by people coming out and giving them that kind of support that I got. We encourage everyone, as Marshall Eddie Conway did during this interview, to support especially the victims of COINTELPRO that are still behind bars. Go to the Jericho Movement's website. There are petitions there. There are people that need support and love and encouragement, and all of that we can offer as a community of resistance. Thank you. National Jericho Movement. Amnesty and freedom for all political prisoners. Jericho is a movement with the defined goal of gaining recognition of the fact that political prisoners and prisoners of war exist inside of the United States, despite the United States government's continued denial, and winning amnesty and freedom for these political prisoners. At the present time, there are Jericho organizing committees operating in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Chicago, Illinois, Los Angeles, California, New York, New York, Portland, Oregon, Richmond, Virginia, and Italy, and regional committees functioning across the country. The Jericho movement addresses four principal issues. First, building the amnesty campaign. A big part of this work is locating political prisoners, compiling dossiers on them, and building the case for amnesty. Second, continuing the educational campaign about the existence of political prisoners inside the U.S. Third, the Jericho Legal Defense Fund, providing supportive expenses for lawyers and law students to provide legal defense for political prisoners. And finally, fourth, the Jericho Medical Project, fighting for adequate and quality medical care for political prisoners. Then, too, Jericho is working with local defense committees to bring the cases of individual political prisoners to the public. Building a bond across organizational lines is what Jericho is all about. That's where the strength lies. Remember, we are our own liberators. Thank you, Jericho, for your work. You can find the National Jericho Movement on the web at thejerichomovement.com by writing to them at P.O. Box 2164, Chesterfield, Virginia 23832, or by emailing richmondjericho@gmail.com. We'll be right back.
Living Resistance members and chapters are consistently involved in actions and campaigns around the world. Here is a brief rundown of some of our recent actions. In February, multiple members presented at the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference in Eugene, Oregon, including Lier Keith as a keynote speaker. Eugene, Laurel Columbia, and Salish Sea chapters hosted events featuring Guy McPherson and DGR speakers on climate chaos and resistance to ecocide. DGR Australia member toured the Philippines with the Mobile Anarchist School. She spoke at universities, info shops, a farmers forum, and many other locations about the need for a serious resistance movement. And DGR Colorado member created Stop Thinning Forest, a website, to inform landowners and counteract the misinformation propagated by the Forest Service and industry. And for actions in March, members of Deep Green Resistance United Kingdom presented and participated in Resisting Together. And portions of the Deep Green Resistance website were translated into 10 languages, including Russian, German, and Arabic.
Join us next week for more resistance news from Deep Green Resistance.
You can contact us at contact@deepgreenresistance.org.
Or write us at Deep Green Resistance, Post Office Box 925, Crescent City, California, 95521.
And we would love to hear your comments on this program and suggestions for future programs.